such great lore attached to it and such a great canon of mythology of the weird stuff that's going on there. But I found that it was completely undocumented, and I really found it by chance. How come these same towns are experiencing a lot of ghosts, but then experiencing high levels of teen suicide and depression and crime? If this was any other thing and we weren't talking about ghosts, and we weren't talking about puckwudgies and cats walking on their hind legs, people would slam their fists down and say, well, let's do a study and let's fund it and see what's going on. Because it touches into the realm of the paranormal, people don't want to talk about it. They sound like a kind, gentle kind of, oh, look, it's the Puckwudgies. And it's really like, you know what, that's great. It's a great story. If you want, I'll sit you or your children down to read you this children's book that was written years ago about the Puckwudgies. But if you talk to the people who have experienced them, they're anything but nice. They wish they could take back their Puckwudgie experience.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 3. It is February 23rd, 2008, and before we dive into the show, let me point out something, an in-house note here. We're having some podcast issues. In short, really, our podcast feed is junk. It's crap. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We've been running it out of a third-party group here for a while, and we're going to be taking it in-house hopefully soon, and all of you folks who use the podcast feed, if you're still using it, I feel bad for you because it stinks. But we should have the new in-house podcast feed set up soon. I'm working on it as we speak. Well, not literally, but I'm working on it. And we'll have that up and running soon, and we'll note it here on the show time and time again. Until then, I suggest you just download the MP3s straight from banalofamerica.com. That's the easiest way to get the show. Because the podcast feed, as I said, it stinks, and we're getting a new one soon, so I wanted to keep you folks updated on that. Now, let's dive into the program. Our guest this week is a good friend of mine, actually lives just down the road from me. He is the author of the new book, Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and the Paranormal in Freetown State Forest, a rising esoteric star. He's got 4 books coming out over the course of 2008. We're talking about the first one here, but towards the end of the interview, we'll hear more about his other books. He is Chris Balzano. Chris Balzano finally here on the program. We had him briefly on for a few minutes on the Mass Monster Mass special, but now we're going to sit down and have a full-length interview all about the Freetown State Forest, which is, I guess to put it in a broader esoteric term, it's a lot like the infamous Skinwalker Ranch. A lot of stuff going on in Freetown and the surrounding area known as the Bridgewater Triangle. We're going to delve into all that good stuff. Bridgewater Triangle, Freetown State Forest, colonial origins, modern day oddities, zombies, witches, the Puckwudgies. I have a feeling that when Chris really breaks into the super mainstream of esoterica, he's going to be riding a Puckwudgie. This thing is an amazing story. We're going to dig all into the Puckwudgie mystery. We're also going to be doing some true crime stuff. Apparently Freetown was a haven for cult activity and bizarre murders during the 80s, 90s, and Chris looks at all that in his new book, and of course, we're going to look at all that tonight in this interview. And of course, as we say all the time, tons and tons more. This one goes definitely off the beaten path of esoteric discussion. I know we just did a ghost episode a few weeks back. We're not doing ghosts here. We're doing weird esoteric stuff going on in the Freetown State Forest, stuff that normally would be marginalized. We're going to be shining the spotlight on it. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Chris Balzano, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Christopher Balzano was a teacher and folklorist living in the Boston area. He has been investigating the unknown for 12 years and running Massachusetts Paranormal Crossroads, a website dedicated to the paranormal and local folklore of Massachusetts, for more than 5 years. His writing has appeared in such respected publications as The Haunted Times, Mystery Magazine, and Unexplained Paranormal Magazine. He's been covered by the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald, the Standard Times, and Worcester Magazine, and has spoken frequently about urban legends and the paranormal at conferences throughout New England. His first book, Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and the Paranormal in Freetown State Forest, is an examination of the supernatural and the criminal activity in a small Massachusetts town. His second, also out in March, is Ghostly Adventures, Chilling True Stories from America's Haunted Hotspots. He is currently finishing up his third book, An Account of the Ghosts of the Bridgewater Triangle. His website is www.masscrossroads.com, MASSCROSSROADS.com. Check it out. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on February 2nd, 2008. Chris Balzano, talking about dark woods, cults, crime, and the paranormal in the Freetown State Forest on BOA Audio Season 3. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Been All of America Audio. It's going to be definitely a fun edition this week because I have a good friend of mine on the program. He is Christopher Balzano, the author of the new book, Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and Paranormal in the Freetown State Forest. And it's really cool for me to have him on the show. He really sort of is my wingman here in the mass paranormal scene. He kind of introduced me to a lot of these players here in the local scene. He knows all these folks. And he's one of the authorities, I would say, in Massachusetts on the occult history, paranormal history of the area, especially this Freetown State Forest area and the Bridgewater Triangle stuff. I had never really heard much about it until I met up with Chris, and he really opened my eyes to so much that's going on here in the state of Massachusetts. Also, yeah, he only lives about a quarter mile from my house, which is quite a change from some of the other guests we've had on the program. I think the last interview I did was the guy in South Africa. So it was, we go from 7,000 miles away to a quarter of a mile. So we're covering close and far here on the program, so it's exciting to have him on the show. As I said, he's the author of Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and Paranormal in the Freetown State Forest. It's from Schiffer Books. Christopher Balzano, I'm so happy to have you on the show finally. We've been talking about this now for almost a year here. Welcome to Been All of America Audio. We actually did have him on the show back in October for a little brief face-to-face sort of interview that I did at the Mass Monster Mash, but I've been really looking forward to having him come on the program here for a sit-down interview where we're not felled by the wind and people walking by and stuff. So I'm excited to have him here on the show. Chris Balzano, welcome to Been All of America Audio.
Tim, thank you very much for having me on. It's exciting to be with you tonight.
Well, let's start out with the bio, the background. Who is Chris Balzano, and how did you gravitate towards this paranormal research?
Well, I've been working in the paranormal field since, I'd say, probably 1994, when I first started kind of chronicling some of the hauntings that were going on in the Boston area, mm-hmm. Specifically ones that were going on in the old Charles Gate Hotel, which was actually my dorm while I was at Emerson. And I just started noting not only that there were a lot of hauntings and that weird things were happening and people were kind of taking interest, but I was also noticing that as people were experiencing things, they started to kind of transform the actual hauntings and kind of basically rip off old legends and mythology and kind of attach them to the same place.
Yeah.
And I started kind of becoming enthralled by this whole notion that we not only experience paranormal, but because we don't really know what to do with it, we kind of fall back on these classic things that make sense to us or that explain things and apply them. So that was kind of my inspiration for really kind of evaluating some of these classic haunted areas of Massachusetts or ghost stories that I was hearing and kind of look at them not only through a paranormal lens, but also through a folklore lens. And then I just started getting more and more cases. And it's funny what you say in your introduction. I am the authority on the activity in the Freetown State Forest because it's never been out there, but there's just such great lore attached to it and such a great canon of mythology of the weird stuff that's going on there. But I found that it was completely undocumented, and I really found it by chance. So I was glad to kind of hit the nail on the head at just the right time.
Yeah. Let's sort of dive into the Freetown State Forest, if you will, and Freetown in general. Give a little, like, thumbnail sketch about what is the Freetown State Forest and what is Freetown for people who, you know, we have people who listen from all over the world here so that, you know, they're unfamiliar with you know, just Massachusetts in general, much less the Freetown State Forest and Freetown itself. So sort of, you know, educate them a little bit about it so we can really dig into some of the lore there in Freetown.
If you have trouble imagining what Freetown is and where it might be, think of the most out of the way place where close to where you are, some place where within an hour you can go from a big city like Boston or even Providence to absolutely nowhere. Very rural area of southeastern Massachusetts where you go from very metropolis, a lot of bustling activity, a lot of crime, actually. And then, boom, all of a sudden, nothing but trees. And in the middle of this town, you have this expanse of forest, which has been set aside, a lot of it for the Wampanoag Reservation, which is a Native American tribe in this area. And then there's just nothing. So it's a very attractive place for a lot of the darker elements, both supernatural and completely natural in Massachusetts, and they find themselves there very quickly. It's also, because of its proximity to Rhode Island, it's also used by a lot of the criminal activity and things that are happening in Rhode Island as well.
Yeah. And then how big would you say the Freetown State Forest is? Because you and I visited there like last April, and we barely sort of scratched the surface of even looking into it for my visit. So how big is that? Is that area?
The Freetown State Forest is about 15 acres. I'm sorry, it's actually 15 square miles, and the whole town is 25 square miles. So you're really talking a large area, and an area that takes up the majority of the town.
Yeah.
But in terms of civilization, it seems like it's just, you know, you've basically fallen off of the earth when you're there.
Yeah, it's very weird. It's a weird place, just from my experience of visiting there. It's got like a quietness to it that's kind of eerie.
Right, and it's which is funny because a lot of what was going on when I was writing the book was during the summertime, and during the daytime in the summer, it's this completely bustling area, and there's little kids running around, there's families having picnics, and it's done a lot over the past, let's say, 15 years to kind of rejuvenate and kind of change the face that it's had in the public eye for so long. But at night, it's a completely different place. It's a very eerie place. People don't like being there. So the good part of it is that at least during the day, it's now has this very positive impact on the community. And a lot of people that go there don't remember a lot of the horrific things that happened there. But those people are still experiencing at least, if not the darker side of the paranormal, they're at least experiencing a lot of things they don't understand while they're there.
Yeah, yeah. And like you were saying, that a lot of these people don't know, like, about the history and how you said that a lot of this stuff wasn't documented. Is that kind of what it's like there now, that they're trying to sort of put that in the past and they don't really want to dredge up that, and the people who are there now kind of aren't in the thick of it like they were back in the 90s or so, when the cult, 80s, 90s, when the cult activity was going on, further back when even more strange stuff was up?
Yeah, they tried to kind of completely deny that aspect of it. For them, it's really, hey, come bring your family down. Here's this great place. Here's Profile Rock. It's a treasure of Massachusetts. And come see this beautiful land, untouched. But it really kind of is, basically like putting a silk hat on a pig, because the activity is still going on there, whether it's criminal activity, whether it's low-level cult activity, that's still happening there. People illegally dumping there. People setting their cars on fire because they don't want to pay the high gas prices. All that stuff is still going on there, and yet they advertise it as this, newer, better, gentler form of Freetown.
And have you run into, I wouldn't go so far as to say harassment, but maybe you will, but have you run into any pressure pushing against you from people in the area that are like, listen, dude, don't be bringing this stuff up. Don't go there, either as a warning to you or just as sort of like in their own interest, where they don't want this coming back up again.
Well, when I originally started doing my research, it was much more of kind of internal conflicts. The police didn't want the fire people to get their side of the story and not share theirs. The fire people wanted to make sure the forest people got, knew what was going on. No one wanted to blame this person, but they kind of were wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah.
Now that the book is written, I'm getting a little bit of feedback and kind of a push from the police, only because they are saying, well, you're kind of taking one aspect of a huge part of our history and presenting it. And all I'm really doing is holding, what might not be the best history of the town up to light. So I'm not saying what I've written is the exclusive 100% history of the city of Freetown or the town of Freetown. All I'm saying is, here's this place. It's really weird. Let's look at it and examine it and kind of look at it from the paranormal aspect of it, this negative energy aspect of it, not, let's record the whole history and get into every great hero who came from Freetown and the parades that happened. All I'm saying is, here's this one element. It's kind of weird. It pointed something bigger, which is what really intrigued me about the location, and let's look at that. So they're kind of worried about people going into the forest now and investigating these things. It's all a very large area for a very small town. police force to cover, but I feel that it's actually probably going to end up being a very positive thing for them, because I think the people that go in are going to kind of bring some spirit back, no pun intended, back to the town.
Yeah, yeah, and like you pointed out, there don't seem to be people there trying to like commercially take advantage of the history. There's no like ghost places or like, you know, haunted restaurants or anything crazy like that.
Right, and that's what actually makes it a very you know, when you investigate the paranormal, everyone wants to grab their camera and go to the haunted restaurant down the street and investigate it and get very excited when they, you know, they hear these stories about it. But here, you know, Freetown is part of a larger paranormal kind of phenomenon going on called the Bridgewater Triangle, where we have in this area of southeastern Massachusetts such a raised heightened awareness and heightened paranormal activity in this one little area in Massachusetts. And all of the activity that's there, not all the activity, but a large portion of it is not commercial. It's not, can't be explained away. It doesn't have a base root core, something you can hold on to. Doesn't have something you can sell attached to it. So when I hear these stories, it sounds so much more real to me and intrigues me so much more because someone is not benefiting from it.
Yeah.
So if someone's not benefiting from it and they're coming forward and giving their story, then that really means that something is going on and something frightening, or else why would they, you know, that they have no motivation other than to kind of try to discover the truth.
Exactly, yeah. Obviously, you go there all the time to Freetown and stuff like that. How much time have you spent in the Freetown State Forest, and talk a little bit about your weird experiences in there? Like, I presume you haven't spent the night or anything crazy like that.
I've never spent overnight. When I first heard about Freetown, this was, you know, probably 5-6 years ago. When I first heard about Freetown, that Halloween, I brought a whole group out there. There was maybe 7 of us, and we investigated, and it rained. It was pouring rain the week leading up to it. This was actually on Halloween, the week leading up to it, and so the entire town, the entire forest was washed out. So we got kind of as far as we could into the forest, and then realized that we were just walking in mud, and would be walking in mud if we stayed. So that was the only time I've ever been there, kind of at night,
mm-hmm.
When things were shut down. I've been there a lot during the day. And it's just this very, it's kind of like being in any major city in the United States, I would imagine, in the world. There's good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods. You definitely get a different feel no matter where you go in the forest. The reservation is a very quiet place, a very tranquil place. You get a very positive vibe from it. The Asonet Ledge, as soon as you get there, you feel this heaviness kind of come over you. You know, if you're on the one side of it and you're looking for like where the Carl Drew shack was, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you can tell he was drawn to that place, or they were drawn to that place because it's a very negative feeling. Even though you're not there at the time then when he was there, you can feel it, and you can almost feel it like, oh, that neighborhood. So it's very weird, though, the experiences that I've had there. I'm very, you know, insensitive. They're probably not the right word to use, but I don't pick up on psychic things. But I pick up on this kind of stuff. A lot of the stuff that has happened to me in Freetown has been stuff that if it was just kind of one thing, you could push it aside. But on one trip with a gentleman I was going out there with, I got stuck in a ditch, for example. Which happened to be you.
Unsavory gentleman. Yeah.
Yes, definitely unsavory. You know, I mean, that's kind of one of those things where if, you know, it was just that, you could push it aside. One time when I was researching my book, I called my wife to tell her I was on my way home. She hung up the phone. She, okay, you know, I love you. Hung up the phone, and when she hung up the phone, slipped, fell down the stairs, and put her leg through the window of the door. So she fell down a flight of stairs right after that. Jeff Blanger and I went out there, and I basically destroyed my car looking for the mad trucker of Copacut Road, which is a haunted legend in that area. I basically went there another time, and all my legs got completely shredded up, and I had to they need a kind of, not dramatic, but medical attention. So there's very, like, small little catastrophes that happen that kind of you can push off because, yeah, well, they're not that big. And then you start to look and realize every time I go to Freetown, something happens. Something I can't explain in a negative way happens.
Yeah, it's strange. It's a strange place. I don't know if I ever want to go back.
And a lot of times, I mean, there's a road that leads to Fall River, and some of the places we've been to together in Fall River doing other radio shows. And Freetown State Forest is kind of like on the left as you're going down this one section of that road. And I've experienced time slips twice there as well. So it's kind of like I'll be driving back from that radio show, and it should be about 1:30, 2 o'clock, and I look down, and all of a sudden it's somehow leaped to 3 o'clock.
Oh, man.
And I'm kind of like baffled, like, okay, I know I was hanging out, talking, like, you know, kind of losing track of time, but when I got in this car, it was 1 o'clock, and now it's 3. And I'm nowhere near home.
Yeah.
Once again, is that something solid you could document, take a picture of it, put it in, you know, put under a microscope? Absolutely not. Could it be a person who's really tired driving, you know, a long ways back to his house? Could be. But once again, it's kind of hovering there. It's unexplained to me.
Yeah. I think that would freak me out more than anything would be the missing time. I don't know. To take a look here at the beginnings, if you will, of where the story sort of picks up here with the Freetown State Forest, and that's the Native American beginnings, really.
Right.
Talk about that whole era, I guess you could say, and the Native American beginnings and their conflicts with the English. And I really found interesting in the book was how the English were sort of like looked down on the Spanish for their way that they did things, but then over time sort of adopted the Spanish way of ultra-violence and then, you know, persecution of the native peoples and all that stuff. It's sort of the activity there sort of caused that turn in a way, and you kind of ponder that rhetorically in the book, but I thought that was really interesting. But let's dive into the Native American beginnings with the Wampanoag tribe and all those great Native Americans and their conflicts with the English settlers.
I think that for a long time we've put Native Americans down. We've repressed, obviously land was stolen, wars were fought, pushed west, and now kind of in our modern era, we've swung the pendulum back the other way, where we have this very, we have this high respect for culture and religion, and a very critical eye towards our role in the extinction of the Native Americans in this country. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that allows us to romanticize what exactly was here before we got here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's naive to think that, you know, when the first settlers, European settlers, got here, Native Americans were holding hands and singing Kumbaya. They were carrying on civil wars, but not civil wars because there was a unifying kind of source, but they were tribes were fighting against tribes, nations against nations, people against people. I mean, it wasn't a peaceful country or peaceful land that Europeans found when they got here.
Yeah.
And they were affected by everything that you would expect any kind of civilization to be affected with. And one of the weird things was with these Wampanoags, who were kind of the dominant Native American tribe in New England, right before the Native American settlers got here, a huge section of their population was wiped out by disease. Now, the weird thing is that if you follow the course of the disease, everyone around the Wampanoags were perfectly fine, some tribes even untouched. And yet the Wampanoags, all living in the Spiritual Triangle, were devastated. So when the Europeans actually got over here, specifically the English, when they first arrived here, they found a very different North America. The Wampanoags were kind of this great power and this great kind of Roman Empire of New England who were losing their power and kind of holding on to as many straws as they could, cooking as many wampum shells, if you will, to kind of regain their power or at least stay on top. And meanwhile, all the tribes around them who had been suffering under the Wampanoags for so long were kind of now taking their shot.
Yeah.
So it really became the key to kind of the Europeans gaining power, because they would basically manipulate all the Native Americans who were going against the Wampanoags and all these other tribes kind of turning against the Wampanoags. And this was kind of how power was determined, exactly how many allies you had in North America. To the point that, you know, it became one of those situations where unless you were an ally to the English, it was really tough to travel. One town would be English, one town would not be English, and or friendly to the English. So if you wanted to go from, you know, what would be Boston to Brockton, you would have to pass 5 different kind of levels and layers.
Oh, wow.
And so what happened was it led to this very kind of somewhat fake conversion to Christianity, because the English then began to say, well, you know, we're not going to do business with you unless you believe in God. So throw away your Native American traditions, embrace God, and then we'll allow you to buy and sell. So the Native Americans who would do that became very popular with the British, and the ones that didn't kind of fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. So obviously the ones in power, the ones with the most to lose, didn't convert, and the other ones did. So what you had was this conflict between the Wampanoags and these Wampanoag splinter groups who were called themselves the Praying Indians, or who the Native Americans called, or the Europeans called the Praying Indians.
Yeah.
And what really started this whole King Philip's War, which is this major war that broke out in 1675, was the fact that, you know, the British were basically, and every time they could, they would just bring Native Americans into their courts and kind of charge them with all these crimes. And finally, it was the death of a Wampanoag at the hands of a Wampanoag, and they were brought into an English court, and they were executed for that. And King Philip, who was kind of the son of the great sachem Massasoit, decided, because basically based on a lunar eclipse, another paranormal event, that they had to go to war. And so what happened was basically a year of the most bloodiest fighting that this continent has ever seen. This put kind of, you know, maybe per capita there were more, or in terms of numbers, there were more people killed in the Civil War. But this was almost barbarism. I mean, it was absolute horrible war atrocities committed on both sides. So what you had were these Europeans who, like you said, when they came, kind of prided themselves on, well, we're not the conquistadors. We're going to come and we're going to make friends with Native Americans. We're going to convert them to Christianity. We're going to create, you know, the perfect society here. And basically what they would then do is beat their heads in with rocks.
Oh, wow.
And then you would have the Wampanoags who would go into an English village and burn the entire thing down, killing women and children. And then what you had was the Europeans going into Wampanoags and basically killing women and children and old people and gathering them up and shooting them, and even though they were defenseless. So this war over this little basically useless piece of land, who no one really wanted up till the point that it became important enough to fight over, and they were just completely leaving their humanity aside. It was disproportionate to what war should have been. And these two basically civilized societies casting aside everything that was good about their personalities and good about what they were as civilizations, and kind of just, you know, going at each other in the most horrible ways.
Yeah, and you kind of raised the issue there that it is so disproportionate that it's too quick to sort of say, oh, well, all the weird stuff's going on because of the Native American history and because of some kind of Native American curse, when really maybe just the area might have something to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, as a paranormal investigator, and there's a ton of different paranormal investigating groups in the area, looking into that, you want to find the source, and you want to find the golden key that's going to make it all make sense. And sometimes there isn't a golden key. Sometimes it's just you've unlocked another door and you've opened yourself up to something completely different. So a lot of people stop at King Philip's War as being like, oh, well, there you go. It has to be this absolutely horrible, these crimes that happened, this violent war. That's what made all this negative energy come in. And I'm kind of one of the first people who said, oh, well, wait, what made them be so violent in the first place? You know, is it the chicken or the egg? Which came first, the monstrosity or the thing that made it? And so I've really hopefully kind of forced people to kind of reevaluate the way that they consider King Philip's War in the context of the paranormal.
Yeah. And then jumping ahead in the book here to one of the stories that I found most interesting, it's in a bizarre sort of way, just because you really don't, I don't hear too many stories like this, and that's just the zombies section of the book. Zombies in Freetown State Forest, I'm tweaked out by that in general. Like I said, because I've never really heard about it. Talk a little bit about these zombie reports and the stories you have here in the book about zombies in the Freetown State Forest. These are relatively recent, not stuff from back then.
Oh, no, this is stuff that has happened in the past. I think the latest report I have is about maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And the most recent report being, you know, 2000
oh, wow.
or so. And this is kind of like if you're a paranormal investigator, imagine this is the miscellaneous folder.
Yeah.
Is it a ghost? Well, it doesn't really seem like it's a ghost because it's really, really solid. Is it some kind of monster? Well, it doesn't feel like it's a monster because it's a human. It doesn't have any really like kind of monster qualities to it. Is it just a crime that you've happened to come across? That seems like it might be one of the most, or at least the most sane explanation, but it doesn't really fulfill everything that's going on. What people are finding in the forest is that there are these people walking around who kind of have a blank expression, move very kind of much in this kind of you know, daunted kind of way, like they're being weighed down by something. Most importantly, they look like they've been just dug up out of the earth.
Yeah.
Now, there is a lot to be said for the demographic of the area. You're talking about a lot of Portuguese, Cape Verdean people, a lot of Haitians who, for them, voodoo and practicing kind of this witchcraft attached to voodoo practitioners and Santeria and Palomao, all are kind of living in that area and have the potential to create these zombies out of these people. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, the classic walking around looking for human brains to eat and mindless creatures. I'm talking more about people who have fallen victim to some kind of practitioner of one of the witchcrafts who's been told that they're dead. Society has told them that when this happens to you, you know, you lose your soul. And they're somehow being used for negative gain in the forest. So people have been actually attacked by these people who look like they've been dug up and move in this very deliberate way, who don't seem to stop. They've even gone so far as to reach into people's cars and try to grab them and pull them out.
Wow. Aside from the people who've told you the zombie stories, have you had any sort of other corroborating sort of thing where, like you point out the Portuguese and the voodoo aspects of it, has there been any sort of connector involved there where, you know, someone might have said, even if it's like off the record, you don't have to tell me who it is or anything, but just someone, you know, where you can connect A to B, if you will? Or is that just sort of a theory?
Well, I mean, I really feel strongly that I've talked to Satanists who practice in the forest. I've talked to Wiccans who practice a very negative form, I mean, a very positive form of witchcraft in the forest. And I've talked to basically every kind of variant in between. And they all say that the Freetown State Forest has this energy unlike any other place that they've ever been. That when they conduct their rituals or their ceremonies or their prayers there, they feel it stronger than anywhere else they've felt it. So is that evidence that another group, such as someone who believes in Santeria, would go there to tap into that same kind of powerful energy? It's not definitive proof, but at least gives me kind of this other level of it making sense that it would be the voodoo practitioners that created these zombies.
Yeah. And the other sort of creature I want to talk about from the Freetown State Forest. Now, I'm sort of jumping around here in the book, and there's tons of great stories and ghost stories and strange stories in there, but I'm jumping on to the ones that I had never heard of and I think the audience hasn't heard of yet. Obviously, they haven't heard of some of these unique ghost stories, but they've heard ghost stories before, but I don't think they've ever heard of these things called the Pukwudgies. And one of the things you're kind of pretty well known for, you're kind of like the Pukwudgie man.
Right. The Pukwudgie guy. Oh,
yeah, you're sort of the Pukwudgie man. So I guess tell people what the Pukwudgie is and you know, fill us in on the Pukwudgies.
Sure. First, let me say that it's really interesting that you should use those phrases to kind of describe us just kind of exploring and delving into this book, because trying to sort through what's going on in Freetown is a lot like jumping around. I really had to kind of have this whole table full of index cards with all these different stories that I was getting, be like, okay, what would I classify this as? It would fall here. So it really was not until you get kind of this kind of look above the whole thing, you have the whole story that you kind of put these pieces together. And one of the kind of interesting underlining things with a lot of this activity that's going on are these Pukwudgies. And these Pukwudgies are kind of classic, if we were Europeans, we would call them maybe trolls. They're 2 to 3 foot tall, human-like creatures. Like, they have very human-like features, arms, legs, bellies. I say bellies because a lot of them describe it as the belly kind of falling over the waistline. The two things that are really odd is they have a really long nose, which some people have described as being canine-like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of hair. So it almost looks like a combination between what we would traditionally call a troll, everything small troll, not big troll,
yeah,
and a werewolf. And so this is a weird kind of combination of the two. And these are creatures that go back thousands of years in Wampanoag folklore. They talk about it, and they talk about it as kind of the, whenever anything would go wrong, would be, yep, you know what, the Pukwudgies are playing with us again. And so if you really trace the history of the Wampanoag people, especially through those disease times and the arrival of the settlers from Europe, you can really find that they changed their role to Wampanoag society. Originally, they were very mischievous and would play jokes and, you know, be very, oh, the Pukwudgies are at it again. Then at some point, the Wampanoag creator god, Mashop, basically goes under the water, has this very torrid love affair with this siren of the sea, and leaves them alone to kind of their own free will of the place, and they end up becoming evil. And so evil words start being used. Instead of mischievous, it becomes heinous. Instead of playful, it becomes evil or deadly. And they end up going into Wampanoag villages and kidnapping little kids and setting the villages on fire. And then they're known for basically drawing Native Americans into the forest using these things that they call Pai Pai Wankas, which it's very interesting to, you know, when you are researching things, when things just line up. If you're a good researcher, you love what you do, those are the kind of moments you die for. And so I'm reading these books, and they're talking about these Pai Pai Wankas, and then all of a sudden they say to them, they make this reference to Wisp of the Wills, which anyone who's investigated paranormal activity knows that's a very early European term for orbs. Mm-hmm. So what they're basically saying in these books, if you follow the path, is they were using these orbs, which they believed were the spirits of the dead, to draw the Native Americans into the forest where they would then kill them.
Huh.
Oftentimes throwing them off of a cliff or drowning them in water. And so this is kind of like what they were blamed on. So when people started showing up missing or dead, mainly probably by disease, people would say the Wampanoags took them and killed them.
You mean the Pukwudgies?
Yes, the Pukwudgies. So what actually ends up happening is, after the Europeans get here, all of a sudden they start, these Pukwudgies start to become the tools of the devil with a capital D. So Christianity is kind of showing its rearing its head in their folklore, and then all of a sudden it becomes, well, the devil sends these Pukwudgies out to do his bidding. But these are things that are still happening today. People are still seeing this Pukwudgie all over New England. I've got cases. I've got a case in Virginia. I've got a case in California. People are seeing these little troll-type things. And what happens was, how do you tell the difference between something and a Pukwudgie? Is the reports kind of draw me in because they describe them as very hairy and kind of evil-looking, and a negative thing happens. But then they also were describing these kind of flashes of light, these, orbs as they describe them, or sometimes they just say rods, these basically explosions of light that are kind of very ominous to them. And they're then reporting these very dark figures that are also around the same area. So when I've got three different elements that are consistent, I say, well, sounds a lot like a Pukwudgie.
Yeah. And so you're getting these, I was going to ask you if this is something that's not just a Massachusetts phenomenon or if they're found in other places. And have you looked not just at the reports that you've gotten from other places in the country, but sort of like in a historical perspective, are they something that might have been shown up in other Native American cultures, like how we have the Bigfoot showing up in various Native American cultures?
Completely. They've been showing up in not only Native American culture, but in old European culture. There's the same references to things that are very similar to that. So I've not only I've heard of and kind of documented cases that are very active today, but also in the lore. And they're called just different things throughout all kinds of different levels of Native Americans here and then old cultures in Europe. And that's how people approach it with me. Hey, I run your website about Pukwudgies. They kind of sound like, and they'll throw out their own regional variant of it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when things get really interesting for me, is when I start seeing the same thing happening over and over and over again in different parts of the country and then different parts of the world. I mean, there's a very similar thing to Pukwudgies happening in South Africa, for example. And it's the same kind of thing going on. So if it's happening one place and the Wampanoags are attributing it to this, and it's happening another place, then you really have to start looking at maybe this is a paranormal creature or a monster that might be much more something that's under our bed than something that's in a book.
Yeah, it sounds pretty interesting. I've never really, like I said, I never really heard of Pukwudgies per se, trolls and that kind of thing, obviously, yeah. But this is really unique and different. And you get, like, contemporary reports of these sort of sightings, too. This isn't just, like you said, it's not just in the lore. Have you talked to people that in the area that have actually seen these things of recent times?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so. I've got one person who said he made contact with someone who wrestled one. And we keep talking about wanting to find out more about that case. But it seems like every time that I am someplace and I'm talking about it, someone has another story to tell me about them. And that's what makes it exciting, because you realize that these stories are all out there. People just don't have a forum to communicate them.
Yeah.
And so it's really kind of this, it's taken on this life its own. So I don't mind being the puck wedgie guy so much anymore because people are feeling the need to tell me exactly what's going on with their puck wedgie world. So
as a strange also element to the puck wedgies that I noticed too, from when you and I went down for Spooky South Coast, they were kind of talking about it. And in the book here, you said, that you were lecturing in Freetown for the Freetown Historical Society and like half the people had heard of them. There's a unique kind of, for lack of a better term, popularity of the Pugwudgies. It seems like, despite the evil connotations and characterizations of the creature, there's sort of a weird, people kind of like them in a weird way.
It's very funny because they sound like a kind, gentle kind of, oh, look, it's the Pugwudgies. I've got, there are people who want to start making Pugwudgie shirts. And it's really like, you know what, that's great. It's a great story. If you want, I'll sit you or your children down and read you this children's book that was written years ago about the Pugwudgies. But if you talk to the people who have experienced them, they're anything but nice. They wish they could take back their Pugwudgie experiences. They don't want that feeling of waking up in the middle of the night to have the Pugwudgie looking in the window at them, basically saying to them, I know where you are, just so you know. So it is just very kind of like we've made a hero out of Freddy Krueger and Charles Manson and these very like things because they become pop culture, but to actually come face to face with one and feel the fear that these people had is a much very different thing going on with them.
Yeah, and to jump back into the forest, let's talk about the Witch of the Woods, because that story was really creepy and definitely one that kind of spooked me out a little bit, especially the cat part.
Yeah. Again, look, one thing, where do you classify this? Like Pugwudgies, are they ghosts? Are they monsters? I mean, what exactly, they touch upon so much that how do you, where do you put them? Where do you put them if you've got that flashcard? On what end of the table? The Witch of the Woods is another great example of that where basically there was this group of boys from a young age up through their teenage years who were all having these kind of nocturnal attacks by this woman who they all described as being a witch. She was kind of evil looking with this disheveled long gray hair, and she would come to them in their dreams. And I was told the story by this one gentleman who's now in his 20s who came to me with the story and kind of wanted to know what was going on, if I had heard anything ever like this. And he basically told me that this woman used to come to his window and asked to be let in. I always think of, when I tell the story, of Salem's Lot with the vampire scratching on the window saying, let me in. Mm-hmm. And he would never let her in. And he always thought he was dreaming. It's got this kind of old hag feel to it.
Yeah.
Except for the fact everything in the Bridgewater Triangle and Freetown has this kind of twist to it, right?
Yeah.
Except for the fact he gets up and goes to the window. Kind of the old hag is she's on you, and she's kind of sucking your energy and making it so that you can't move. So whether her physical description is very much like an old hag, instead he gets up and goes to the window and has a conversation with her. And these attacks were almost all at night. And he would sometimes have dreams of her where he would go to this house in the woods near him. And he actually would go there. He would find her engaged in kind of a sexual way with a Native American, and then he would kill the Native American. And this happened, this kind of dream happened several times to him, until one day him and his friends were out there in the woods, and they found the house. They found the foundation of this house that he had never seen before, but only dreamt of. And he said, this is really weird. I have this dream, there's this woman who attacks me, blah, 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 blah. And he ended up finding out that his friends were having the same exact dreams and were describing the same exact woman. One of them actually was sexually assaulted by her because he let the woman in at night. And then the parents came in and they found him like basically as if he was being held down and forced to do things he didn't want to. And they were completely baffled as to why this would happen to him. So this area became very kind of known throughout the neighborhood, and people all throughout their teenage years, this one group of kids, kept experiencing this woman. And as they got older, it kind of got more intense. But there were other paranormal things kind of playing around there. One of them was this very kind of almost like a mirage type of ghost that they would often see in the woods. And the other one was this very weird cat who would walk on two legs, walk on hind legs. And they saw this several times, always attached to time when there was other kind of paranormal activity. And they would see this cat basically walking around like a human, almost as if it was some kind of a witch familiar or someone who was kind of being used by the witch in a classic kind of Salem, you know, the witch and her black cat, and sometimes the witch is the black cat.
Yeah.
So this thing would run around on its hind feet and kind of pursue them sometimes even. And so it becomes this very kind of weird story of this witch who had attacked them at night, and these weird things they were seeing in the woods, and these kind of like, like the predator in the woods, kind of seen but not seen. You would see this very weird shape kind of moving. And then this cat who would randomly show up. No one in the neighborhood owned a cat. No one had ever seen the cat unattached to something weird or paranormal. And all this stuff was kind of playing itself out just right across the street from the forest. Basically, the only thing separating the forest from this neighborhood was Profile Rock, which is another great haunted location in the forest, and then a large cranberry bog.
Yeah, that's one of the stranger stories, and I give hats off to you in the book, because it could have been, you know, you could have just done a book on just ghost stories of the area. And I'm sure you have a book in you of just ghost stories of the area, but this book really hits on a lot of other weird stuff. Do you know what I mean? There's the Pugwudgies, the zombies, the witch in the woods. I mean, there's a lot going on there that isn't the the five basic food groups of paranormal activity.
Right. I think a lot of people stop at that level of well, there was a fight and guy A shot guy B, and that's why there's a ghost. But you can't partly because I think that's kind of just boring and done before, and partly because you don't have that in that area of Massachusetts. I wanted to dig deeper and say, wait a minute, how come these same towns are experiencing a lot of ghosts, but then experiencing high levels of teen suicide and mental health disorder and depression and crime? Is it possible that they're connected? I mean, if this was any other thing and we weren't talking about ghosts and we weren't talking about Pugwudgies and cats walking on their hind legs, people would say, you know, they would slam their fist down and say, well, let's do a study and let's fund it and see what's going on. But because it touches into the realm of the paranormal, people don't want to talk about it. And it's one of those things where you can go town by town by town in the Bridgewater Triangle area and see this kind of thing happening. And what I found out is that Freetown is not only probably, you know, a good example of this, but it's also kind of a symbol of everything that's either right or wrong, depending on how you look at it, about the Bridgewater Triangle and southeastern Massachusetts. And a great place for us to begin exploring the connection between all of these kinds of things. You know, we're in kind of the paranormal and the supernatural goes in cycles, and you talk about this very well, about, you know, right now ghosts are very popular. And we're coming off, like you talk about, coming off the swing of like 9/11 conspiracy theories being very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And that our eyes are averted to certain things over periods of time. And so often it's you know, well, I study ghosts, and so I think that cryptozoologists are idiots. And don't even get me started on those ufologists.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of splintering of all these different groups. And anyone who's kind of someone who studies everything, people say, well, you're just kind of, you know, an ADD supernatural investigator. We haven't never really sat down at a conference or just kind of sat at the table all together with law enforcement, with mental health people, and said, hey, let's all look at this together. So I know a book can't do that kind of thing, but I hope to at least kind of sit down as an expert in some of those things, or at least, you know, someone who's experienced in a lot of those different aspects of the world, kind of sat down and said, let me take one town in Massachusetts and see if I can do it with that.
Yeah. What's an ADD paranormal investigator? I never heard of that.
I invented it 2 seconds ago. No, what I'm saying is if you take someone who's, you know, for example, you know, in the early days of the Internet, it was okay to have, here's my website, and it's dedicated to ghosts and UFOs.
Yeah.
And nowadays, that's unheard of. You can't do that. You can't. No. You know, especially after kind of the TAPS revolution, ghosts are ghosts and UFOs are UFOs, and never the two should meet. If you're a paranormal investigating group, you lose your credibility if you start talking about aliens. And if you're a ufologist and you start talking about the potential for there to be, you know, ghosts kind of, you know, on a dark and stormy night, you lose your credibility. So I guess what I meant by an ADD supernatural investigator is it's a derogatory term for people who, in other people's eyes, get into too much, put their fingers in too many pies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like a doctor who says, well, you know, I'm an oncologist, so I don't study the brain. So if there's something going wrong with the brain, I'm just going to consider that outside of my realm and not get into it. And it's like, you know, one part of your body kind of has everything to do with it. It's kind of, you know, we need to appreciate that specialization and become specialized if we feel the need to, but really kind of become an expert in everything that's going to kind of, you know, explain something. You know, especially paranormal investigators are very much into, you know, this being a science now and this being something that you have to go through certain techniques and certain standards for anything that you gather to be considered relevant. And so therefore you kind of have to leave these things aside. Well, scientifically, you should really try to, you know, however silly it sounds, the first thing you should say is, well, could this be a UFO? Well, could this be, you know, a Bigfoot or a Pukwudgie or some other kind of cryptid? Well, okay, now that I've get those things out of the way and I've explained away it, you know, in terms of like a natural thing, now we can start looking at the paranormal aspect of it.
Yeah. You raise a rhetorical question. Let me jump back to the Pukwudgies. What do you think? Cryptid or something, you know, beyond paranormal? I guess you could say they are cryptid because they're an unclassified creature,
right,
but
right.
Would you say, you know, like a flesh and bones type of maybe a lost race or an animal of some kind that's, you know, smart like a Bigfoot? Or do you think it's something that's like supernatural in a way, interdimensional or magical, if you will, for lack of a better term?
You know, you're supposed to kind of stay away from this kind of stuff in a way, but not for me. I think it definitely has something to do with something more closely related to a demon. I think that they're very much like during, you know, demonology will tell you about this hierarchy that exists kind of in the demonic realm and these different things that, you know, one attacks and the others kind of swoop in like vultures and kind of snack on what's left behind. That sounds like a Pukwudgie to me. That there's this hierarchy of these orb lights and then the Pukwudgies and then these kind of shadow dark men who are there. So to me it seems like, you know, and I hate to get into the religious aspect of this whole thing, but once again, it exists there. I think they feel a lot more like demons, to be honest.
That's what we're looking for, honestly, man.
And this is actually the first time that I've ever kind of said that before and kind of, you know, looked at, well, what exactly is it rather than just allowing it to exist. But to me, it really feels like something much darker and much more evil and something that was very much enticing in that early lore.
Yeah.
And considered harmless until it was allowed to roam free and kind of go wild, and then it went wild.
Yeah. And just from one of the stories in the book on the Pukwudgies about how, and you kind of referenced it here, about how the Pukwudgie saw the guy and then somehow was at his house or something like later. You know, unless it's, you have to have access to some kind of, you know, higher intelligence, I guess you could say, to know where someone lives if you saw them like that. You know what I mean?
Right,
if it was just
right,
an animal,
right.
I guess it could follow the scent. Maybe I'm underestimating the ability of animals, but I don't think so. I think there would have to be some kind of higher intelligence there where it would know that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, not to mention the fact that, you know, in their early lore of these Pukwudgies, they're described as almost being like air. I mean, they're described as being fireflies, being able to turn themselves into bugs and light and disappear. They're described as being able to turn themselves into the wind. Things that kind of defy your classic cryptid description, something very solid, maybe something, like you were saying, more interdimensional, but something that definitely is not your standard, if we can have a standard, which is kind of, you know, kind of weird to say, but not your standard kind of unexplained animal, but much more something kind of that's tapped into some kind of higher intelligence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the big debate in Bigfoot studies. It's been the big debate for generations now, you know, flesh and bones versus supernatural. So it's only natural, no pun intended, to extend that, I guess you could say, to the Pukwudgie debate. With your work and as you get more sightings and reports and stuff like that, I have a feeling that this won't be the last we hear of the Pukwudgies. I have a feeling this might be one of those stories that's going to break through, that's going to get bigger as time goes by now that it has a name. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right. And now that it at least has kind of a little bit of momentum behind it, because there are no, as far as I've kind of experienced, there is no shortage of people who have experienced something that kind of touches upon this Pukwudgie experience. And so it seems like we're really kind of just at the beginning of maybe an upswing of people, now that it's being talked about, reporting their own cases. And then we can really start to evaluate and separate. Because I'm actually already even seeing kind of two variants of the Pukwudgie itself, physically. You know, there's kind of a dark one, which is less hairy, and then a one that's almost red-like and has much thicker hair, unnatural hair, as opposed to just very hairy, like a hairy human. One that's actually almost like more like a furball kind of one.
Weird. And with the risk of misquoting him, has Lauren Coleman said anything about the Pukwudgies? That seems to be almost in his wheelhouse.
I believe he's mentioned them. I know that the first person to use the expression in terms of activity in the area, I believe would have been Joe Citro. But you know, whenever you quote anything like that, and you don't say that Coleman said it first. He always can turn around and say, well, actually, I said it, 15 years ago in this thing, and so I'm probably going to say, Lauren Coleman's kind of the center of everything, especially seeing that he coined a lot of the words we use in this area to investigate. And was the first person on the cases of a lot of these classic cases that are in the area. So I want to say that he might have, but I really kind of, I latched onto it because of Joe Citro.
All right. Well, when I get Lauren back on the show, I'll make sure I ask
him. He's definitely heard of them. He's definitely heard of them, and I believe he actually said, oh, yeah, you had this case here. And actually, when we were at the Monster Mash together a few months ago, one of the people who's was with Coleman, but not with him, but kind of from the same town in Maine, said, oh, yeah, here's a Pukwudgie story from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I know, and I think he had said that he had spoken to Lauren about it. So it's definitely one of those things that's known.
Okay.
I don't need to live in this physical realm. I walk around in the physical realm, and I put on the faces, and I talk, and I play, and yeah, it's just a big act, man.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
In the spiritual world is where I live. I exist in places you never even dreamed of.